from KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuliner. It's been nearly 150 years since the close of the U.S. Civil War, but the effects and some of the arguments continue to be felt today. 2 years ago, a petition allowing Texas to secede from the U.S. received over 100,000 online signatures and prompted a response from the White House. Here in Missouri, lawmakers last year pushed a bill to nullify all federal gun control laws in the state. It ultimately failed, but that hasn't stopped legislators from introducing similar legislation in this session. Today on Intersection, we'll talk about the lasting effects of the U.S. Civil War, examine the re-energized states' rights debate, and talk about the other ways the Civil War is felt today. Joining me in studio, Frank Bowman is the Floyd R. Gibson Memorial Endowed Professor of Law at the MU School of Law. Frank, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
And Marvin Overby is a professor in MU's Department of Political Science. Marvin, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And we won't be taking any calls today on Intersection, but you can send your comments and show ideas to intersection at kbia.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at intersectkbia. Okay, so to just start the show off, maybe we'll just dive right in. Frank, maybe tell us a little bit about some of those parallels between pre-Civil War America and what we're seeing in politics and, I guess, the country today.
Well, I don't want to overemphasize the parallels, and I don't want to suggest we're about to plunge into civil war, but certainly some of the rhetorical themes that you've seen in politics over the last few years echo the kinds of rhetoric that one would have heard here in Missouri and around the country, particularly in the South during the Civil War. Particularly the idea of nullification, the idea that states have essentially a sovereign right to nullify or ignore or proceed contrary to federal legislation, has raised its head again. One would have thought we'd put that more or less to rest, first of all, in the nullification crisis of the 1830s and then more definitively after the Civil War, but that doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, you have legislators here in Missouri who profess to be able to pass laws which they claim to believe are enforceable that would, for example, prohibit federal law enforcement officers from enforcing federal criminal laws. Now, frankly, as a constitutional matter, that's preposterous. But that kind of thing is certainly resonant of the pre-Civil War period. And there are other things that one might say. But.
Sure. Well, yeah, and Marvin, again, in Missouri, we've seen some of these efforts. I mean, specifically gun control legislation and the Affordable Care Act, things
sure.
like that.
Sure. And it goes to maybe a larger point here, which is that Missouri is one of those states that's just right in the middle. I'm fond of saying it's the northernmost southern state or the southernmost northern state or the easternmost western state or the westernmost eastern state, depending on how you look at it. But a lot of this, the rhetoric that Frank was talking about, a lot of these ideas, they sort of come from that antebellum southern period. And it's worth remembering, as I tell my students in my southern politics class, what the word south, where it comes from. And it comes from the old Anglo-Saxon word for sun. And it's a reminder that until the 20th century, most migration in the United States tended to be from east to west. So you didn't have a whole lot of north-south migration. So if you sort of draw a line eastward from Missouri, you're in Virginia, right? And that's mm-hmm. where so many of these early settlers came from. So that's part of the reason. I mean, these things have long historical reaches. So it's part of the reason why parts of Missouri looked very southern. Mm-hmm. It's part of the reason why Missouri is a slave state entering it in the Missouri Compromise. And it's part of the reason why you have elements of the Missouri culture that still find great sort of psychic connection to that antebellum southern attitudes related to nullification and states' rights and a sense of not being fully in the federal fold.
Right. And how does that attitude play out now, given some of the national perspectives and national, I guess, approaches to politics right now?
Well, in many of the ways Frank was just mentioning and that yeah. you mentioned earlier, you know, this attempt to pass what is it called, the Second Amendment Protection Act or something in the state Senate, probably going to be vetoed by the governor again, would certainly be struck down by federal courts if it were ever enforced. And it's, you know, as a political scientist, I'm struck and always wondering how serious people are about these things. It's quite possible that the state legislators who are voting for this either haven't contemplated what it would mean to enforce this law or really don't want it to be enforced. Right? It's sort of a classic collective action problem. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't actually like Missouri to have to defend this in a federal court where they would certainly lose. But for political reasons, right, it gets them votes.
So that's why they're pursuing this?
That's my cynical but realistic view of the matter.
And so what does that get them, I guess, politically?
It gets them reelected. Yeah, and it gives them something to talk about. And it appeals to that part of the Missouri public and public opinion that is skeptical of the federal government, anti-federal government. We generally group these people under the general rubric of Tea Party, even though that probably doesn't do complete justice to all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and by nature, this conversation has to be a little bit speculative because there's not a lot of...
And painting in broad strokes.
Yeah. But I guess, Frank, I wonder your thoughts on that as well, the idea of why these politicians are maybe introducing some of this stuff, you know, whether it is in earnest or not.
Well, I yield to no one in my cynicism. So I think there's a cynical element here, plainly a posturing element. But I think at least some of the people who vote for this stuff or propose it either believe that they're standing for a legitimate constitutional principle or they wish they were. And I think that kind of thinking really has deep roots, at least in parts of Missouri history, and has a lot to do with the Civil War, which is of course our topic for today. And there's a couple. The first point I want to make, and there's a number of things I think would be fun to talk about. But the first point I want to make, I guess, is the listeners may be thinking the Civil War. Oh my Lord, we're talking about the Civil War. That's something that happened 150 years ago. It's so over. It's how obscurantist can you possibly be? But I want to make a couple points. First of all, it's not that long ago. You think about it, 150 years is not that long. It's really only two moderately long lifetimes, of 75 years. My dad, who's still alive today, is 92. He was born in 1922. When he was born, there were plenty of people alive who had fought in the Civil War. A person who in 1865 was 20 years old would only have been in his mid to late 70s by the time my dad was born. Moreover, the people who, if you focus not just on the people who fought in the war, but the people who were being raised both during the war and who were born and being raised in the Reconstruction period, those folks essentially grew up and controlled the American political system well into the first third of the 20th century. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who was one of our most famous Supreme Court justices, famously fought in the Civil War, described it as he talked about later on in a speech about how, he said, in our youth, our generation was touched by fire. Very famous speech. Holmes was still on the Supreme Court in 1932 when my dad was 10. So the Civil War and the post-Civil War generation was actively in control of this country well into the middle part of the 20th century. And those folks, of course, passed on their ideas, their perceptions of the world, their notions of proper social arrangements to their children and grandchildren. We're only really a couple of generations removed from folks who had an active, vibrant memory of the whole Civil War period.
Well, and I guess we're saying, too, that you should point out that the stuff we're talking about, this rhetoric is stuff that even preceded the Civil War. It's not necessarily something that came out of the Civil War, right? So this is something that we're talking about even further back.
Took us into the Civil War.
Right. Yeah.
Was very important, the kind of thinking we're talking about is very important in the post-Civil War period in Missouri. One of the things the reason I'm sitting here, because I'm just a lawyer after all, a historian only by courtesy, is that I fiddle around a little bit in the legal and social history of central Missouri. And one of the things that I often talk about to people, particularly young people here in Boone County, is they don't realize where they are.
historically. I mean, Boone County was the third largest slaveholding county in Missouri. It was part of the slaveholding, the central slaveholding district along the Missouri River. And the people who lived here in the Civil War were certainly emotionally and socially almost exclusively Southern sympathizers. You could not have found an abolitionist in this town, certainly not a vocal one, because he would have been strung up at any time prior to 1860. Even though a number of very prominent people after whom streets and buildings around here are named, Rollins, Switzer, Guitar, other people, even though they held for the Union, they were all slaveholders. And after the war, for those folks, even though the folks who held for the Union and the people who were essentially secessionist were all white folks, when they came back together, they came back together here at least remarkably, with remarkably little conflict, not necessarily true everywhere in Missouri, but here remarkably with remarkably little conflict. And in part, I think, that's because the fundamental social assumptions that they all had about the way in which society ought to be organized. That is, for example, black people either ought to be slaves, or if not that, they ought to be essentially a peon class of laborers. Mm. That white people, you know, ought to necessarily be superior and superior into the indefinite future. That the more radical parts of Reconstruction were anathema. Both the Union and the Confederate sympathizers around here after the war essentially coalesced around a really pretty common set of views about the world, and ultimately they recoalesced in what became, you know, the modern Democratic Party. So those folks are, you know, the ancestors of, you know, and form the dominant social class in most of Missouri for the next century. Mm-hmm. So it's hardly surprising that some very Southern ways of thinking about things, things about ways of thinking about race, ways of thinking about the federal government. For example, you know, even these previously pro-union folks were not necessarily happy about a lot of things that the federal government did either during the war or during the Reconstruction period. So those attitudes, those anti-central government attitudes, those social attitudes, those go back a long, long, long way, and they don't change that fast.
And remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the ways in which the Civil War is felt today. Joining me in studio, Frank Bowman is the Floyd R. Gibson in Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the MU School of Law, and Marvin Overby is a professor in MU's Department of Political Science. We'll not be taking calls today on Intersection, but please send comments and show ideas to intersection@kbia.org. You can also follow us on Twitter @IntersectKBIA. To that point, Frank, do you think that you kind of mentioned at the beginning of what you just said there. Do you think that's that legacy of slaveholding, and do you think that's remembered in Boone County?
Well, the interesting thing, of course, is in Boone County, it's not. At least not by people who are sort of people associated with the university and so forth. I mean, and one of the reasons that I find it interesting and fun to remind people is that people tend, in the 21st century, tend to think of Boone County, because it's the University of Missouri, is sort of this little liberal enclave in the middle of Missouri, which, as a matter of voting, it is. If you take a look at the election maps for the last couple of elections,
blue dot.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
There are two big blue and one small blue dots in Missouri, and one's in Kansas City, one's in St. Louis, and Columbia is right there in the middle. Mm-hmm. Because of that, people tend to think that it's always been that way, and of course, it hasn't been that way at all for very long indeed. And in fact, the university itself was actually a bastion of pro-slavery and indeed Jim Crow thinking up into the 1960s. Before the war, in the 1850s, the president of the university was a guy named James Shannon, who was one of the most radical, fire-breathing pro-slavery orators in all of Missouri, so much so that even the essentially pro-slavery folks in Boone County urged to get him out because he was such a firebrand. He, in fact, he actually actively urged undergraduates at the University of Missouri to join armed bands to go into Kansas to suppress the abolitionists. Mm. And of course, you know, that sounds like, oh, that's just a really long time ago. But again, the history of the university thereafter was hardly what we would now think of as particularly enlightened on lots of different social axes.
Yeah, the yearbooks used to have KKK advertisements in them well into the 1920s. I know.
Really?
A couple of things that Frank said struck me. One, going back to his earlier point, that the Civil War is not really that long ago. It's worth remembering that Missouri had a state-funded veterans home for Confederate veterans up until almost end of World War II. There were still Confederate veterans alive living in the state home. Another thing is to think about, because a lot of this, even though sort of focusing on the Civil War, has to do with slavery and the effects of slavery. Mm-hmm. And I think that in so many, many ways, the effects of slavery are still with us today. And one of the things I do in my Southern politics class that I like doing, and I hope the students like it, is that I'll ask them, what is slavery? And invariably someone will say, well, slavery is a free form of labor. And, of course, that's exactly wrong, exactly backwards economically. Slavery is a very expensive form of labor because it tends to capitalize labor, leaving very little money left over for other investments. So what you get across the South, and you know, in a slave state like Missouri, too, which is sort of Southern, is that you get a tendency to invest so heavily in slaves that you underinvest in all sorts of other developments, including land. Because in the pre-Civil War South and pre-Civil War Missouri, land didn't actually have much value. And the value inherent in the slave property. And when the land was worn out, slave owners had every incentive to sort of leave and move to new fertile land. And that has all sorts of implications for the way people think about land, even decades and generations later. Hmm. It has to do with sort of what efforts are put into town building, what efforts are put into developing things like education, what efforts are put into developing things like universities. Because if you don't think that you're going to be here or your children or grandchildren are going to be in a place to capitalize on those investments, you don't make them. Hmm. Right? Hmm. That's why you see sort of an underinvestment in education historically across the South.
And do you think that's something we still see in Missouri?
Oh yeah, we still see the implications of that because it's very hard to catch up, right? In places where you had this historical attitude of we're going to use up the land and move on, you don't see the history of road building, of infrastructure building, of canal building, of railroad building, of investment in towns, and you see certainly part of that in states like Missouri.
Interesting. So you think there are some examples even in Columbia? Yeah.
I think to a large extent, yeah. And you know, you get an institution like the University of Missouri, which is a fine institution, right? My employer, they sign my paychecks. But think of what a better institution it would have been if for the first 20 or 30 years of its existence, it hadn't been essentially in a slave-holding state where a lot of the population was thinking, we're not going to be here. As soon as we were out this land, we're going to be moving in 10 years. Why invest in it? Right? And that's one of the reasons why it sort of across the nation you see the older, better universities are in northern tier states and southern tier states, well, we have football.
Well, I mean, you ask about what other things that we see in Columbia that are artifacts of that era. Leaving aside the street names, and you have the geography, the populational geography of this town is a direct artifact of the end of slavery, because what happens once there's an emancipation, which finally occurs in January of 1865, you have a displaced black population, some of whom stay and work associated with their old owners, but generally speaking, they move, they're no longer sort of on site. And they're all pushed up into an area in sort of northwest Columbia, the same area where a very large portion of Columbia's black population lives today. That area was dramatically underdeveloped. And simply left out of city planning and city resource allocation for a century and a half. It's very interesting. This shows you a relationship between the city and the university and sort of where we are and where we've come from. In 1904, a guy wrote a master's thesis in the sociology department. It was called The Negroes of Columbia, Missouri. And on the one hand, It's an, have you ever seen this?
No.
You've got to read this.
Who's the author?
Oh, the guy's name is William Wilson Elwang, 1904, Negroes of Columbia, Missouri. On the one hand, it's a brilliant piece of sociological research because the guy goes out and he collects a huge amount of data on how the black people in Columbia are living, the circumstances in which they find themselves, education, employment, family status, and whatnot. And he concludes that it's all miserable. Right? They're undereducated. Family structures are terrible. They're living in slums. Many of them don't have jobs. They certainly have virtually no education. Their employment prospects are lousy. It's terrible, 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 terrible. All that part of the master's thesis is great and useful and commendable. But the last half of it is, well, why is this so? And basically his answer is, well, because they're Negroes, right? It's their fault.
The answer's obvious, right?
Yeah.
1904, yeah.
And his basic recommendations are things like, we should deprive these people of the right to vote because they don't know anything anyway. They certainly shouldn't be educated for anything higher than labor because they're unsuited for that, and so forth and so forth and so forth. Now, this is 1904, and this master's thesis was so well thought of by the university and the sociology department that they took the unusual step of actually publishing. Mm-hmm. Now, that attitude certainly permeated, certainly not unique to Columbia, or unique to Missouri, and indeed not unique to the South, although probably more virulent in the South. But that attitude towards the black population of Columbia certainly persisted, that's now 45 years after the Civil War, and it persisted, not without that much change up into the 50s and 60s, when finally, grudgingly, this community desegregates.
But, second Reconstruction,
yeah. Right? I mean, the geography and the whole social structure of this town is a legacy of the Civil War, its post Civil War period, and you cannot, if you open your eyes, you can't miss that here.
Ryan, if I could put in for the sociology department here, which I don't normally do.
Not picking on
me. Another famous sociologist came out of the sociology department here, got his bachelor's degree and master's degree, a guy by the name of Herbert Bloomer, who developed a notion that's still used to discuss race, and that's the notion of the color lines. And he develops that while being here at the University of Missouri and essentially getting run out of town for making statements in the early 1920s that whites and blacks were essentially equal with sort of no basic differences between them. And that got him run out of town in the 1920s. And he went off to a brilliant career at University of Chicago and UCLA, I believe.
Take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the ways in which the Civil War is felt today. Joining me in studio to discuss the topic, Frank Bowman, is the Floyd R. Gibson Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the MU School of Law, and Marvin Overby is a professor in MU's Department of Political Science. We'll not be taking calls today on Intersection, but please send any comments to intersection@kbia.org. You can also follow us on Twitter @intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at kbia.org. Just go to kbia.org and scroll down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. So before we go to the break here in a few minutes, I thought it might be good to get back to where we started talking about nullification. We talked a lot here about some of the background on a number of different topics on the things that we came out of the Civil War, the attitudes we had. But why are we seeing a reemergence of this idea of nullification on such a large scale just recently? Marvin, maybe it's good for you to talk about that.
Yeah, that's a good question, Ryan, and I'm not sure I've got an easy answer for it. Maybe a little background on this is that nullification has been with us for a long time, right? And people on both the left and the right of the political spectrum have at different points in American history argued in favor of nullification. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison argue against nullifying the Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790s. You have South Carolina famously arguing for nullification of tariffs and other things in the 1830s. You had northern states arguing to nullify the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1840s and 1850s, I guess. So you get both sides sort of weighing in and thinking that, that federal law should be nullified. And you still see that today, right? You have states passing laws related to same-sex marriage or to marijuana use, or seeking to nullify federal laws in place on those matters as well. We've seen a lot of it. In part, I think, it's because we have never fully come to grips with what sort of federal society we're going to be and whether we're going to be one where there's greater emphasis placed upon federal supremacy or one where we place greater emphasis on what's sometimes called the liturgy of localism, right? More local control. And the founders left that vague in the Constitution. There are elements of the Constitution that both sides can point to and go, there, it says right there, that it should be this way. And people tend to flip-flop on that, I think, depending upon what the issue is that the federal government has taken a stand on and where they stand on that issue. So I'm not sure there's an easy answer to that, although here in Missouri, we tend to see it as elements on the conservative side of the spectrum, at this point in time anyway, wanting to nullify what they consider to be more liberal federal laws. But that has not historically been the case, and it's not the case across the United States right now.
Any kind of time frame, I guess, on when this has been something that's been more present?
Since what's known as the Second Reconstruction, since the federal government started, really beginning in World War II with the Supreme Court weighing in on what's called the whites-only primary, and then the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s and 1960s, Civil Rights Act of 1964, Voting Rights Act of 1965, some more conservative elements nationwide, but particularly in the southern tier states, arguing that the federal government had exceeded its brief and overstepped its authority.
And some of that is, of course, healthy, I think. As Marvin said, I mean, this uncertainty about the precise balance to be struck between the national government and the states has been present since the Constitution was first enacted. And I mean, I suppose you can argue that to some degree the founders may have intended there to be some ambiguity. Certainly, they drafted the document in a way that made ambiguity inevitable. And to some degree, it's healthy. That states should push back against the national government. The national government is not always right. Sometimes it's dreadfully, tragically wrong. And that's a good thing. What may be a little bit different about some of the nullification rhetoric now, which makes it more akin to what you saw before the Civil War, is... And I don't want to overemphasize this point, but the implicit linking of some of the nullification claims on the right with overt armed resistance to the federal government. Now, you don't have anybody, necessarily, it's certainly no one respectable claiming we should take up arms against the federal government. But particularly when you link nullification to enthusiasm for the Second Amendment, and you justify some of your arguments against gun regulation on the theory that we need to have guns not merely for hunting, not merely for self-protection, but precisely in order that we can take up arms against the overbearing federal government, that's a very different kind of thing than, passing a law in Colorado legalizing marijuana when it's illegal federally.
We'll have to take a short break and we'll get right back to that. Today we're talking about the ways in which the Civil War is felt today. Frank Bowman and Marvin Overby are joining me in studio. This is Intersection. I'm Ryan Femuehlner. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the ways in which the Civil War is felt today. Joining me in studio today, Frank Bowman is the Floyd R. Gibson Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the MU School of Law, and Marvin Overby is a professor in MU's Department of Political Science. We won't be taking calls today on Intersection, but please send comments and show ideas to intersection@kbia.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at @intersectkbia. So, yeah, we had to stop there for a second, Frank, to go to the break, but maybe just pick back up where you were talking about, I guess, the threat of violence here. And, you know, I guess also to point this out, you know, the Second Amendment on its ground is, you know, an armed is the ability to have a militia. I mean, how realistic is that that may even happen, that, you know, the idea of overthrowing a government, that's what it was protecting at the beginning, because that's how the United States was founded. But, you know, that idea that it's meant to protect would be really incredible to be played out if it were to happen. You know?
Well, you know, I suppose there's a couple of questions. One is the military reality of actually trying to resist, you know, the United States Army with guys carrying around revolvers and even for that matter, you know, semi-automatic, you know, M16s. Not terribly practical.
Right.
But on the other hand, again, right underneath the surface of a lot of arguments that you hear on the Second Amendment is this notion, romantic or delusional, though it may be, about that we need to have our guns because the federal government is an oppressive power, and we have to have at least the potential to resist that oppressive power with violence. Now, you know, to give the Second Amendment folks, strong Second Amendment folks, their due, at some level, that was the point of the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you can't really deny that. That was the point. Now, I think it's dreadfully outdated and to some extent horribly dangerous to think in modern society in those terms. Not necessarily because we're going to end up with the Second American Revolution or the Second American Civil War, which is what it would be, in shooting war terms, with big chunks of the country breaking off. But I do think when you use nullification rhetoric, when you use it in connection with, you know, the right to carry guns around, when you, as is true in Missouri, you have legislatures actually saying that, you know, national officers enforcing national laws are subject to arrest by local sheriffs for enforcing national laws, you're creating, I think, an invitation to some folks who are perhaps not as firmly grounded in reality as some others to actually take things into their own hands, to start shooting. And I don't think that is completely crazy to think of, that violence can happen. I mean, one of the things about being, even by courtesy, a historian, or for that matter, being interested in international affairs, I think, is that if you look around, you realize how extraordinary our social peace is. Look at Ukraine. It is not that hard for an apparently modern, peaceful, well-organized society to start to fall apart at the edges and to degenerate into violence. And I think when people talk, as some folks do when they talk about these kinds of issues, you're tearing at the fabric of society in ways that ultimately have the potential for very bad outcomes.
And that's very much a worst case scenario, I guess I would say. But what are some of the other, I guess, threats or pitfalls of this sentiment, I guess?
Ryan, as usual, I'm not going to answer your question.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah,
go for it.
Let me point out what I consider to be sort of a delicious irony here, and this area of discussion is rich with ironies. I think, right, if you look back across American history, the most restrictive use ever attempts to restrict gun ownership and gun use were actually employed by white Southerners in the Black Codes to keep black citizens, recently emancipated black slaves, from owning and using guns, right? So it's in this area of the country where today we see this, you know, rah-rah, Second Amendment is sacrosanct. But this, you know, the forefathers, the forebearers of these folks were the ones who actually have the probably the historically best usage of restraining gun rights when they didn't think those gun rights would be what in the hands of the people they thought should have them. So that I think there's a delicious irony there. During the break, we were talking about the fact that whether or not these areas that are talking about open defiance of the federal government, talking about secession, really would like what they got if they actually seceded from the Union. And I just poking around today and looking up some facts about sort of which parts of the country benefit most in financial terms from being a part of a rich federal society like the United States. And it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that sort of almost the redder the state, the more federal green it is getting. It's sort of, different ways of measuring this. Fox News has a list of the states that get the 10 most from the federal government. And, Virginia's on that list. Kentucky's on that list. Alabama's on that list. West Virginia's on that list. If you look at The Economist magazine, they came up with they took everything the states had gotten for the last 20 years versus everything they'd paid in and compared it to their gross domestic product. And sort of states like Mississippi tend to be at the very bottom of that list with a deficit owed to the federal government of 254% of their GDP in 2009. If you take Mitt Romney's famous quotation about, the 47% of the people who pay no taxes, well, 8 of the 10 states with the highest percentage of those 47%ers are in Dixie, right? Mm. This is a region of the country that gets much more back from the federal government than it pays in. And they're being sort of ungrateful about it. Mm-hmm. And I'll say that as a Southerner myself from one of these states that gets a hell of a lot of money from the federal government. Mm-hmm. But again, sort of the rich ironies of this.
So is that why this may continue to be a Southern phenomenon, or do you think that this could gain traction in other states as well that don't have those?
Well, you do see it in other parts of the country as well. You see it in Alaska. You see it in some of the sort of survivalist camp up in the Pacific Northwest. But it does tend to have sort of a Southern flavor, both because of the Civil War antecedents and the historical example, and because you tend to have that echo here of people who are, again, ironically, or both very patriotic and also very interested in at least talking the rhetoric of it's time to walk away. And again, it's nothing new. The Confederate States of America, the great seal of the Confederacy, was the profile of George Washington. They saw themselves both as American patriots and as rebels at the same time.
And there's another thing going on here, I think, in that much of the sentiment that drives this kind of secessionist talk, this nullification talk, that drives some of the more, extreme elements of, at least I would call them extreme elements of the right wing, comes from some not surprising alienation, I think, from the currents of the rest of America. I mean, we are no longer, if we ever were, a society dominated by, white Protestants, and who controlled all the levers of power and who yielded nothing to either people like black folks who came over as slaves or, for that matter, immigrants of some other kind. I mean, traditionally, for example, again, coming back to Missouri in the Civil War, pre-Civil War, post-Civil War era, this was the Confederate sections of the state, or the secessionist, basically pro-Southern sections of the state, were profoundly nativist as well as being slaveholders. And whereas the pro-Union people in Missouri tended to be often, they tended to be either immigrants from outstate or from elsewhere. The German population of Missouri was a huge component of the pro-Union forces in the Civil War. And that basic sentiment that the
the nativist, white, Protestant, conservative, agrarian, local as opposed to national, that vision of America it's gone, and I think people have a hard time letting go of that. It feels foreign in the sense of alien, discomforting. And when people are asked to deviate from what they know, what they feel comfortable with, they fight in one way or another.
Well, and this is not just a Southern problem or an American problem. It's a human condition.
Sure.
Right. Well, and will there always be a sense of this now that politics has become so polarized, I guess? I mean, that has to, I guess, contribute to what you're talking about. People can latch on to these ideas that are...
Yeah, and maybe it's sort of bringing this to the here and now. One of the reasons we may be seeing it is because of the polarization we've seen in politics. An incumbent member of the state legislature or the Congress is less and less afraid of a general election challenge and more afraid of a primary election challenge. So you get these Republican members of Congress and Republican members of the state legislature who are not really afraid of facing a Democratic challenger in the general election. They're worried about keeping down their right flank back at home against the Tea Partiers other more, even more conservative elements. I mean, you see people like Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, and it's hard to find a more conservative senator, but facing an attack from the right in the primary this year.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, is there any, do you see that changing anytime soon? I mean, I guess things ebb and flow over time as history shows. But,
yeah. Ever is a long time. but, there are some reasons to suspect it's going to be with us for a while. And one of those reasons is because for a variety of causes, we have both separated ourselves out more because society is very mobile. We both separated ourselves out more. And both the computer hardware and software exist for legislatures to go through and draw districts that are reliably conservative, reliably liberal, reliably Republican, reliably Democratic in ways that you couldn't do before the days of GPS and the like. So my guess is it's with us.
Until, I mean, again, they have to be a huge sea change,
until
I suppose.
Happens,
Yeah. Take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the ways in which the Civil War is still felt today. Joining me in studio, Frank Bowman, is the Floyd R. Gibson Memorial, or Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the MU School of Law, and Marvin Oberby is a professor in MU's Department of Political Science. We'll not be taking any calls today on Intersection, but please send comments and show ideas to intersection@kbia.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at IntersectKBIA. Another thing that we see a lot of that I think, just guessing here, there's a little bit of parallels between what we saw leading into the Civil War and today is the use of religious rhetoric in politics as well for, on both sides, really. So when I guess that's probably a pretty common thing, but when that's been a pretty consistent thing we're seeing on the national and local scale as well. Marvin, maybe your thoughts on that and its use historically here in Missouri.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly see it. And from a comparative international perspective, it's weird. There are not a whole lot of places in sort of the industrialized Western world where you get politicians sort of trumpeting what church they go to, what denomination they're a member of. In the research I do in places like Canada, which is in many ways very much like the United States, it's actually difficult to find out what a legislator's religious affiliation is. Here in the United States, it's one of the first things they mention on their website or in their campaign literature is pictures of them coming out of the Baptist Church or the Catholic Church or the Methodist Church or whatever. It's in many ways it's distinctively American. And I yield to Frank if he has any ideas on why it's distinctively American, but it did sort of come up at sort of this time period America was founded, and you see these waves of these sort of passionate outbreaks of religion in the United States that you didn't see as much in Western Europe. At least you didn't see as much in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. These great awakenings, they were called, where you'd have this sort of this fervent oversweep of religious fundamentalism come through.
I mean, does it make compromise more difficult? Again, talking to the point of polarization.
Sure, because you're talking about people who are not just wrong on an issue; they're also evil on an issue, right? They're not just ill-informed; they're sinful, and you see it especially on a broad array of issues related to sex, right? Abortion, who should be getting married, and I think the country generally is moving in a more liberal direction on a lot of those matters, especially gay marriage. But that is not equally true everywhere in the United States. There's a good bit of variance on it.
Certainly, religion has been employed as a method of political persuasion or a rallying cry for one political end or another an awful lot in American history. And I do think maybe, well, certainly in recent times, say last couple centuries, more here than most of the rest of the industrialized West. But, you know, again, Civil War, classic example. I talked before about James Shannon, who was both the president of University of Missouri in the 1850s, but and also a Congregationalist minister. And so his preaching in favor of slavery was not essentially political. It was partly political. But the basic thrust of his argument was that slavery was a positive good commanded by the Bible. And in that period, of course, religious people on both sides of the slavery issue employed religious rhetoric to considerable effect. And in fact, the church denominations in the United States are now oftentimes divided. They were certainly specifically divided in several cases by the war, where you had northern and southern iterations of the same denominations. Why we have Southern Baptists, and that can echoes of that continue today in people's religious affiliations even now.
And Marvin, we kind of got to this point before too, but is there room for an American center anymore? You talked about redistricting and all the technology that's changed the way politics happens now. Is there even room for that? Or, I mean, especially considering how polarized we already are right now.
That's a really good question, and it is complicated by the way we run our government in the United States. It may be that other countries like Great Britain have these issues, but the fact that they have more of a unitary state and they do not have the separation of power system we have may make it easier for them to deal with. We have a president who's elected nationally, but we then have members of the Senate and members of Congress who are elected from these subnational, sub-state, in the case of House members, districts, where they are by both constitutional edict and by historical development, supposed to represent not some sort of national will, but some sort of very local considerations. And so you get a presidency that appears to be, right, if any of us, I think, were doing bets on it, we would say the Democrats are getting close to having what may be a demographic lock on the presidency, right, because of these shifts in the overall demographic makeup of the United States. And yet you see the Republicans being able to win a majority in the House of Representatives and a reasonably comfortable majority in the House of Representatives, even though they're getting, I think in 2012, a million fewer votes than the Democrats.
At least.
Got. Yeah. And so you're looking at a situation where the country is being pulled in two different directions because of this constitutional decision made in 1787 based upon good, sound, liberal democratic theory that you want to divide up political power in different institutions representing different constituencies. But that makes the process of governing difficult, and the founders, I think, anticipated that, but they didn't anticipate exactly how and why it would be difficult.
The only thing I would add to that, I guess it's a little bit of a dissent, is that it seems to me this the problem we have is by no means purely structural.
No.
It doesn't – I mean – the problem we are currently experiencing in sort of the dysfunctionality of the federal government is made worse by the separation of powers provisions of the Constitution and so forth and so on. But I'm old enough to remember a time when it was possible to achieve something like consensus, possible to talk with one another, possible to horse trade. Now, some of that, again, has to do with the sort of the purification of the two parties. You don't, and here too, this is in part a legacy for what happened for a long time, and what made a lot of things possible in American politics in the 20th century was itself a legacy of the Civil War. Democrats were essentially the party of either vaguely Southern sympathizers in the North or, after the war, the party of the South, and remained so until 20 years ago, 10 years ago in many places. But somehow or other, over time, they also, the Democratic Party also managed to draw in African Americans, managed to draw in immigrants, managed to draw in folks from the North into this polyglot hodgepodge of a coalition that made it possible to do lots of things. But now all the folks who are Southern Democrats are all Republicans.
If they're white.
Yeah, if they're white. Mm-hmm. All the white Southern Democrats are all Republicans now, with almost no exception. The black population, which started out after the Civil War as being entirely Republican because that was the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation, has essentially migrated completely to the Democratic Party. And, I needn't go into all the rest of that. We sort of know where we are. But the legacies of the Civil War and its, the 100 years thereafter, as people readjusted their political interests and alignments, made it possible to do things by speaking to one another, by compromising, not necessarily always politely, but more politely than we seem now to be capable of doing.
Well, and one thing, this polarization that's been talked about on the national scale, I mean, we've seen this play out, that these party leaders, the party elites, may not be able to keep people rank and file as they maybe used to in the past. I mean, Marvin, maybe I'm seeing you nodding your head to that. I mean,
yeah, it occurred to me as Frank was speaking that if you want to take a depressing view of this, it was the breakdown of the Democratic Party as a national institution that really plunged America into civil war in 1860 and 1861. It is good for society, I think, to have these institutions that bridge the regions, that bridge the interest. So as Frank was talking about, you had Southern Democrats and Northern Democrats, and they would get together and cut these deals. It strikes me as that the Republican Party may be going through some of this now, is that they are losing in some ways the ability of the leadership to keep together a national party. And, as a political scientist, I'm fascinated by this because who are the Republicans going to nominate in 2016? I mean, there's no obvious – for the first time, I think, in my lifetime, there's no obvious Republican nominee just standing out there sort of the next in line. And part of that is a deterioration of the party's ability to operate truly as a national institution because they have been battling sort of amongst themselves and fighting off attacks from their own right, much more so than from the Democratic left. So if you want to draw a depressing parallel, it was the breakdown of the Democratic Party in 1860 that was a real problem, and similarly, the breakdown of the Republican Party could be a real problem.
And just a few minutes left in the show. I mean, to that point, what from the Civil War, what lesson are we not learning right now? We've forgotten at this point. I mean, that sounds like that's one of them. But what are some of the others? I guess, Frank, that we're not getting to right now, people are forgetting about that. We may be doomed to repeat.
I don't know if this is exactly responsive to your question, but I think the main thing I think about when I think about the war and present circumstances is the failure of memory about what happened then, the failure of memory about what happened thereafter, our essential failure as a society to deal with many of the much of the aftermath of the war and of emancipation, our essential failure for a century to deal with the legacy of slavery. The thing that I think of is, and it's underlies so much of a lot of the debates we have now as a society, is we want to forget all that. I mean, that's yesterday. That's in the past. We should be able, you know, people say, well, that none of that matters now. It matters immensely. We have not managed to solve the problems of a racially divided society. We have not managed to solve the problem of slavery yet. Not completely. God knows we've made immense progress. We have a black president. That is an achievement of inconceivable magnitude if you think about 1865 or even 1965 for that matter. If you look at this town, look at this town with this wonderful university and its otherwise thriving economics and lively cultural scene and all that sort of stuff. In the midst of this wonderful town, there is a group of folks who are not integrated into the intellectual and social and cultural and economic life of this town, and that fact is a raw sore that needs to be addressed, and it is true in so many places around this country. We have not dealt with the basic structural problem of this country. We have not dealt with the original sin in the Constitution, as people have so often called it, to this very day. Not completely, not satisfactorily, until we do, until we're willing to address all the issues that came out of the Civil War. We're doomed to some degree of dysfunction, I think.
Marvin, any other final thoughts from you?
I would only add that I agree with Frank wholeheartedly on that. I would just simply reiterate, America's not alone in this. Trying to create multiracial, multicultural societies is difficult. You see it in Ukraine, you see it in Syria, you see it in Belgium, you see it a lot of places. We still have a lot of work to do. And when I say we, I mean human beings, not just Missourians or Americans.
We're going to have to end it there. That's all the time that we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests. Frank Bowman is the Floyd R. Gibson Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the MU School of Law, and Marvin Overby is a professor in MU's Department of Political Science. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersections is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersections produced by Raymond Tongakar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Sifan Uyong and Casey Morell. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.